Count to ten.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
We're interviewing former Senate President Bill Mathers, longtime legislator from the Miles City area at his home here in Miles City, Montana, on the 7th of July, 2005. Bill, what in your background or what experience caused you to become interested in politics?
We had a local Republican club, and I belonged to that, and then I got involved in the school board, and then in 1959, I believe it was, the legislature had a graduated land tax, and I thought that was outrageous, and I thought, well, if I'm going to complain, I ought to do something.
Now, what was the graduated land tax?
Well, the more land that you own, the higher your tax.
I see.
And I can't remember who introduced it in the House, but it was introduced.
Probably in the 59 session?
Yep, yeah. 59 session. Mm-hmm.
Now, how did it come that you joined the local Republican club?
Jim Lucas and a group of us that were my friends were kind of the organizers of it. And Charlotte and I just got involved in the Republican Party then.
What caused you to gravitate toward the Republican Party? What was it about the Republican Party?
I think that the thing was that they thought like I did. You know, they're more conservative and didn't believe in just spending everything in the world that you could get hold of for welfare programs and programs that I thought were unnecessary. So I just got involved in it and thought, well, if you're going to sit around and complain, do something about it.
Was there a Republican leader or somebody that might have been an inspiration to you? Was your boyhood or at that time? Or?
Oh, no. I grew up in the South, so I grew up under Democrats. My father and grandfather were all Democrats. And when I moved to Montana, even before that, I had felt the closer relationship to the Republican stance on political issues than I did on the Democratic stance. And when I got up here, Jim had just come back from school, and there were a group of us that were young Republicans, and we just formed this club and got started in the political arena. Lucas was one of the pushers, Andy Elting. I don't know if you ever remember Andy. Andy was involved in it. Bowman was part of it. There were just quite a group. Tim was here for a while, but he wasn't involved so much in that. He moved to Billings before we got really wound up in that. But he lived right down the street when I first came here.
Now, Governor Aronson was governor at the time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you were aware of him, I imagine. And
yes.
Certainly President Eisenhower.
Yes,
and they were both popular public figures.
No question about it, yeah. Yeah, Hugo was quite the man. I never did really know him well. He came to the Senate a couple of times when I was first in the Senate. Nutter had become governor by then, but Aronson was there, and I can remember the introduction. This was a couple of years. Well, after I got into the Senate, after I'd served two terms in the House, Aronson came and was recognized, and I can remember his speaking to us on the Senate floor.
Yeah.
Quite a man.
Yeah.
Quite unusual man.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Big and rough hewn and very genuine.
Yeah, he really was. He really was.
So 1960, the election year 1960,
mm-hmm.
Eisenhower has left office.
Yes.
Aronson has left office, so it's kind of the beginning of a new time in the politics of our state and our country.
Yes.
And were you approached by someone and said, someone say, Bill, why don't you run for the legislature?
You know, I don't remember that part of it. I just got involved and thought, well, I'll just give it a shot, you know. And Lucas and my friends here kind of supported me in the idea. And Jim was running for county attorney, and so I ran for the House. Ted Nelson was the other.
Ted Nelson?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was the other candidate.
And let's see, I think I served with his son. I think his son was elected later from Billings.
From Billings, that's correct.
So
just one term, I believe.
Was there an incumbent that you had to run against?
No. No, I didn't. I ran against two Democrats, but...
You and Ted were the Republicans.
We were the two Republicans. Lucas was running for county attorney. Nutter was running for governor. Babcock was the lieutenant governor candidate. And I'm trying... Oh, Bill Greaves was running for the Senate.
Okay.
And all of us were elected that year.
And then you replaced Bill Greaves in the Senate then
yes.
A couple years later?
Yes, Bill decided not to run for a second term, and so I just moved up to the Senate and ran for the Senate in, that would have been 63.
So, Bill, you were in the, you were from Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You lived in Montana for what, 8-10 years before you ran?
Yes, I came to Montana in 1951, so 9 years actually.
And so the political scene in Helena would have probably been a little unusual to you. I would presume you'd probably been to Helena a few times before.
No,
you like,
very just once before I was ran for office. But you know, you stop and think, the Democratic Party in Texas was more Republican than it was Democrat at that particular
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
So made a difference too.
Sure.
Their philosophy. Was so much like the Republican philosophy was up here. You got to remember the Democrats were controlled in that time by the Farmers Union and the labor unions, and,
yeah.
and mostly those two organizations really had a club over everybody's head in that particular time.
In fact, in the 1959 legislative session, the Farmers Union, I think, and the labor unions had a fair amount of clout and influence.
And that's one of the reasons I think the Republicans got started so well, because they just went overboard on things, and that was one of the reasons I got involved, was because of the actions they had taken, and I was interested enough to keep kind of posted on what was happening in Helena, and that's one of the reasons I got involved.
Yeah. Can you think of what about the Farmers Union philosophy as you understand it and the FFL-CIO philosophy as you understand it would be different than what mainstream Republicans thought then and what Texas Democrats thought then?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think taxation was probably the big thing. The Farmers Union, of course, they don't and still don't tax their dividends, and they were expanding quite rapidly. Whether it was good or bad, I don't know. Maybe time will tell, and as you go along a little further now even, I think the Farmers Union has done a fairly decent job in the last few years of protecting the interests of the farmers.
Yeah.
I don't believe their interest is as good as the Farm Bureau,
yeah.
but I do think they've done a fairly decent job.
But I think we probably both noticed that there's been a change in the Farmers Union.
Oh, no question
I
about
that.
I think
it was far more of a militant, populist kind of an organization in the 50s than it was in the...
Oh, yeah.
80s.
Yes, very much. Very, very much. Yeah, they were very outspoken, and the people that you could tell who was from Farmer Union country when you were there, and with their arguments about the different taxation programs and everything.
Yeah.
And government support, too.
The graduated concept in terms of property tax might
yes.
have been something that they would have supported?
Yes, and I wish I could remember, but I can't remember what two legislators introduced that. But I can't remember who it was.
Yeah. You know, in that same session, the 59 session, there was an effort made to establish what were called public utility districts,
mm-hmm.
PUDs,
yes.
that might have been born out of the same kind of a philosophy.
Yes. I think so, too, and I felt that at the time, that was part of their program, too. Of course, it was opposed very strongly by Bondina Power, but in general, most people, if they stopped and thought very long and gave real steep consideration to what was taking place, would oppose it, too.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's one of the reasons the Democrats lost so strongly in the 1960 election when Nutter was elected and the Republicans took control of the House. They didn't have Senate, but they did have the House. Clyde Hawkes was made Speaker of the House. Jerry Anderson was the majority floor leader.
Any recollections of Clyde Hawkes or Jerry Anderson?
Yes, Jerry was a very good floor leader. And Clyde was a good speaker too. He was fair, and I didn't try to run over the Democrats, I didn't think. I thought he was a good Speaker of the House. He really was. And Jerry did a heck of a job. And then Alex Blewett was there too. And Alex, along with Jerry and Jim Hoy, they were good leaders of the House for the Republican Party.
Do you remember Ted Schwinden?
Very well.
Mm-hmm. And of course, he was a member of the House at that time too.
Yes. Yes, and Ted was a. I've always thought that Ted was a very intelligent man. I mean, he was just very capable. I admired Ted quite a lot. I didn't know him that well in the House. He didn't stand out like some of the others did. But I can't remember. But the guys from Butte were the ones that were the big. Supporters of the Democrat Party, and I can remember one time they was a barber from Butte, and he and his sidekick started a filibuster in the House, reading from the newspaper and all of that, and I can't remember their name. But finally got it shut off.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't heard that story before.
Yeah.
They filibustered you for a while. Huh?
Yeah, right, yeah. I wish I could remember their names.
Well, let's see, there was a guy named Shugru, there was a guy named Tracy.
No, it wasn't. I knew them too, but this was before they were there.
I see.
I can remember where they sat. They sat on the far side of the House, on the Democrat side, those two seats on the far side. And the two of them started this filibuster. And I don't even remember what the filibuster was about, but I can remember that quite well.
So there you were, a new legislator. Maybe you'd seen the legislature in Texas, in Austin, Texas.
No, never had.
When you arrived there as a member, was probably about the first time you'd ever seen a legislative body in your life.
That's right, exactly right. I never had seen one function. And so it was really interesting to me. And I worked hard and studied hard on the whole thing, and I enjoyed it. I had a good time. That's why I kept running, I guess. But I made good, wonderful friends. You know.
It's wonderful that way. That's no question.
Yeah.
That first election in 1960, you were running with Don Nutter.
Yes.
Any impressions of him?
Oh, yes. I was on the Appropriations Committee in the House, and I can remember so well, I had the appropriation for the Highway Patrol. And the state at that time was, I think it was just $2 million in the hole. And Don was, boy, we were going to get out of that, and we weren't going to increase taxes. And he was a strong leader. He really was strong. And I can remember that he called me to come down to the office, because on the Highway Patrol, I had given them in the report that I had to give to the Appropriations Committee, I had gone along with their request for some additional money. And Nutter called me down, and he let me know that we weren't going to make any additional money for the Highway Patrol or anybody else. And I talked to him quite a while. I didn't say too much because I was rather shy. And he was going to have us, the Highway Patrol had to go to to get their gas, they had to go to the highway departments within each town, like down here, to get their gas because they could save a little money. And he wanted them to have retread tires. And he really clamped down on them. And we just couldn't quite see that. And Rex Hibbs from Billings was the senator on that subcommittee. And Rex and Nutter were good friends. And so I came back and I told Rex what was happening. He said, well, now don't worry about it. He said, I'll go down and talk to Don tomorrow. And we'll see if we can get it. Well, he did. As a result, the Highway Patrol didn't run on retread tires. So.
Well, boy, that doesn't sound like a good idea to me.
No, but it was saving money.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. Dick, Reed was the first budget director. Can't remember his first name, do you?
Don't remember, no.
But I know he had an office down there. Just as you came into the Capitol, up the front steps, and just to the left, he had an office, and very proud of the fact he was very conservative. He didn't have file cabinets in his room. He got a bunch of boxes of Apple boxes, and that used to use those for file cabinets. And everywhere there was a penny to be saved, he saved it. Went a little overboard. Yeah, he really did. Oh, my.
But that impressed the governor, no doubt.
Oh, I'm sure. Yes, yeah.
Because Nutter was, from everything I've learned and read and heard, was a very strong fiscal conservative.
Oh, very.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I think in that 61 session bill, the legislature might even have actually cut back. I mean, sometimes, you know, we've got the way of understanding the budget where there's the, I've forgotten now the terminology that's used, but you consider the natural growth rate in the economy,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And you apply that statistic. So if you, mm-hmm. the state was spending $100 million and the economy grew 5%, then current spending, I think, would be something like $105 million, mm-hmm. which you would assume would be what the next legislature would appropriate. And I think because the budget was out of balance, not only did that 61 session balance the budget, but it did so actually by reduction, so that there was a real reduction in that session. I mean, real dollars from what had been appropriated in 59.
That's right. There's no question about that. I can remember meeting with the Board of Examiners, and they were pretty upset, too, because we were cutting their budget, too. But Norris Nichols was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee that year, and Bill Gowan, I can't remember who all was members of the committee, but my goodness, yes, we cut every budget. Didn't make any difference who it was, Republican or Democrat, that was head of the committee. Their budgets were cut because we had a $2 million. I think it was $2 million. It may have been more, but I know that we were in debt, and we weren't going to raise taxes to take care of that, and we cut the budget. And of course, then the growth of the economy offset a lot of that, and so actually we did more damage than good, I think. But we did cut her back.
So then what happened in 63? Apparently maybe the...
Well, we kind of reversed ourselves in 63, and we're a little more lenient. See, Don was killed.
Yes.
And it was Tim's first session as governor, and we were more lenient then, and appropriated more for education and more for all the programs in the state. And of course the state was growing too then, you know, the economy was growing and we could afford to do those things, but we didn't get carried away even then. So Tim was a good leader too. We could visit with him, and I knew him personally since he'd come from Miles City originally, and then that was Lucas's first term. So we had a good working relationship with Tim and got along quite well as far as the Appropriations Committee is concerned.
Now, Bill, there was probably quite a contrast in leadership styles between Don Nutter and Tim Babcock.
Oh, yes, yeah. Don would make you nervous when you went in there, and Tim you could kind of sit down and relax with. But, boy, Don was rather hard-nosed. And, of course, I was such a freshman, you know, and Rex Hibbs saved my life because he and Don were such good friends that I he could talk to Don. But I, as chairman of one of those subcommittees, I had a heck of a time.
Yeah. And Tim was more, of course, you did, as you mentioned, you had a somewhat of a hometown connection with Tim, but Tim was more relaxed.
Oh, yes, you could talk and visit with Tim, and he'd listen. He'd give his point and tell you how he thought things should be, and why he felt that way. But he would listen to you too. So I got along quite well with Tim, both terms.
Now you've mentioned Rex Hibbs. You've mentioned Jim Lucas, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We've mentioned Ted Schwinden. In that early period in the House of Representatives, are there any other representatives? You mentioned Norris Nichols that mm-hmm. kind of stand out in your mind.
Well, of course, Jerry Anderson. Jerry yes. was a strong floor leader and did a good job. He really did. And Alex Blewett was another one that I thought quite highly of. And on the Democrat side, of course, Francis was a hard worker.
Francis Bardineau.
Yes, Francis Bardineau. Yeah, no question about that. Ted was there too, but I don't remember Ted being that strong a leader. And I'm trying to remember who was the minority leader for the Democrats, but I can't remember right now.
I think Jerry Anderson was for the Republicans in 61, and Alex Blewett was for the Republicans in 63, and Hawks was the Speaker in 61, and Frank Hazelbaker in 63, I think.
Right, right.
Now, Gene Turnage first came to the House in 63.
In 63, yeah. And now, one of the greatest debates on the floor of the House, excuse me, was Lucas and Turnage.
Really?
I can't remember what the topic was, but I remember they were debating, and Francis Bardo thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened.
Well, that is really interesting, Bill, because, of course, they had both been county attorneys.
Yep.
For about the same amount of time, for about 10 years before they both entered the House of Representatives.
Yep. And both excellent speakers.
Both
very
speakers.
Intelligent.
Yeah. Holy gosh.
Yeah, but it was a great day when they had that debate.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I've not heard that from either one of them.
Yeah.
So
they may not remember, but Francis would have remembered because he made the comment, that's the greatest debate.
Those two smart young Republicans going after each other.
Yeah.
He really enjoyed that.
They really did. Melcher was there too. See, Melcher started in 61 also. He wasn't such a leader in the Democrat Party, and surprisingly enough, Melcher voted with the Republicans quite a bit of the time too. In fact, they put him on the Legislative Council, appointed him to the Legislative Council during the interim.
I see.
And because of he wasn't such an outspoken Democrat that some of them were.
Yeah. Huh. And then did you serve in the Senate with him as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I never felt he had that much influence in the Senate, but of course he was from the same area as Dave Manning, and I've always thought Dave was one of the outstanding legislators of all time. And a tremendous man, but Melcher was there also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that's when he ran for Congress.
Yeah.
His second term, I believe it was.
1968 or 1969 in the special
long
election,
in there.
I think,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So the 1960 period when you entered the election of 1960, when you entered the House of Representatives, was kind of maybe the beginning of the waning years of the old Anaconda Company.
Oh, yes.
In
you know, and I can't remember them having all that. Crippen.
Lloyd Crippen?
Lloyd Crippen represented the company. And he didn't have that much, they really didn't have that much influence. The power company was the one that had the influence, Montana Power, because George O'Connor, you know, had been Speaker of the House two sessions, probably a tremendous parliamentarian, and he had a group working with him, and they were quite influential, I felt, in the Republican Party during those sessions, and they became quite strong.
His working group were Republican legislators?
Yes.
Do you remember any?
Of the Republicans that, are there...
The Republican legislators that might have worked closely with George O'Connor?
Oh, I think that Jim... was Jim never went overboard, but he was working with them because of their philosophy and the things that they believed in that we did. I remember that I carried the bill to tax the co-ops, and the power company gave me a lot of information that I used in the debate on the floor to place the power company under taxes, Farmers Union.
Yeah.
Because we were trying to tax their dividends, and you see, still aren't taxed. But then that was the stroke. We got it through the House, but of course it didn't even last long enough to hardly get the breathing room in the Senate. But it carried the House. I had a big time carrying that piece of legislation. So I worked closely with George. And there was another member of that group that I can't remember. It was before Shuey became a member.
He was a lobbyist?
Yeah. Shuey was with the wool growers.
Yeah.
But I can't remember the other lobbyists for the power company that were with George O'Connor. His brother was president later.
President of the Senate?
No, president of the power company.
Joe McElwain?
No, poor Joe. Brother was an attorney for the power company. Shucks, I can't remember.
Oh, Corrett.
Corrett, yeah, Bob Corrett.
Yeah.
Bob Corrett,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Jack Corrett was president of the company, and Bob was a lobbyist and lawyer, yeah.
That's right. And he was one that I got acquainted with then. Yeah, had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
In fact, we later, several years later, you know, Bob and George. No, Bob didn't go. It was Shuey and Lucas and myself, and Bob Corrette and his son. No, George and his son, George O'Connor's and his son. We all took the company plane and flew to Texas and went quail hunting on my ranch, my brother's ranch down there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, we had a great time. They really enjoyed that. took them to the WCTU, and that's one of the few organizations that still is existent. They've got a building and everything, Women's Christian Temperance Union. And they thought that was great. I took them to, they had a big dinner there while they were there that was a fundraising program. And they thought that was great to go for that bunch of guys to go to WCTU for dinner.
Because the WCTU I associate with the temperance movement.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Prohibition.
So you got these hot quail hunters after a hot, dusty day out in the sunshine hunting quails. That's not the best place to go for a cold beer.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't even beer sold in the town. So.
And that was your hometown?
Yeah. You know, it's right near there. Still isn't. It's still
a dry county.
Still a dry county.
I'll be darned.
All of those.
Got to be one of the very few left in the country.
Oh yeah. And I think it is the only WCTU building that's in existence and functioning. You know, so they actually run the library and do local things now, but don't have the big Christian temperance programs that they had then. But it was fun to go, and they really got a kid. Bob Corrette and George O'Connor really thought that was great.
So then you went back out to the Mathers Ranch and had a little bourbon and branch water before you went to bed,
yeah,
I suppose. Huh?
Yeah. Down to the motel, you know.
I see.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my. So your impression was that the Anaconda Company was still a presence.
Oh, yes. Lloyd did a fairly decent job, but they weren't as influential. You know, then they did. I don't believe they owned all those newspapers at that time.
They sold them in '59.
Yeah, because so they didn't have the political clout they had prior to my service in the legislature. But Cripp did a good job lobbying for their positions and all. But there wasn't any really strong issue, as I can remember, as far as the company was concerned.
The Anaconda Company had what was known in common parlance as a watering hole or a hospitality room.
Oh, yes. Lots of them, though. They weren't the only ones.
They weren't the only ones. Did Montana Power have one?
Yes.
What are your recollections of those?
I think that's probably one of the best things that they had. A lot of people were critical of them, but you would go there, Democrats and Republicans. You would associate, you got acquainted with one another, and became friends with the Democrats as well as the Republicans, but it was completely open. Well, it wasn't, I know the, I believe it was the power company, always had a great big roast that you go in there and get a sandwich and free drinks, of course, and hors d'oeuvres of all kinds. They never pressured you in those water holes. But they had one, the power company had one. Later, Jerry Anderson, representing the Green Stamps, I believe it was, had a room. Petroleum company, Baseline Acropolis, had one. Petroleum company had a big one. But actually, I think they were a good thing because everybody went there. I mean, the Democrats, I used to say that the guys from Butte, that's where they ate all their meals. but they were really, they served good food and served lots of drinks, and it was a good time.
So after working up a big appetite from conducting a filibuster on the floor of the Butte delegation, they'd head down to the water.
Yeah, and all of us would. Yeah, just a matter of which one you wanted to go, because they you'd be scattered around all over, but it didn't hurt anything. No.
And the legislators didn't make that much money then either. It was something $10 a day, I think.
$10 a day, no expenses either. And we worked for 60 days, and then the money shut off. At the end of 60 days, you didn't get paid anything. I can remember that because Tim was lieutenant governor, and we were all out for dinner, and she said, well, I'll pay for dinner tonight. We didn't have lobbyists, just us, just a group of us. and he was going to pay because he thought his money was going, his salary is going too, but his salary wasn't going either, so he got stuck.
He got just plain stuck.
Yeah, right. Another one that a lot of fun later on was Bill McKay. He was really, Bill McKay and Jack Brenner were two of a kind.
Now, Bill McKay was a senator from, I think, Carbon County, and Jack Brenner from Beaverhead County.
That's right.
Both Republican senators.
Both Republican.
Both prominent ranchers.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and the McKays, of course, the McKay family, they made the donations to the museum, all of their Charlie Russell memorabilia, the pictures and everything, because Bill McKay's father and Charlie Russell were personal friends. And Bill told me about Charlie Russell used to come back east where his father and Bill grew up and would stay with them. They had an estate, and I can't remember just where, but a fairly good-sized estate. And he's telling about the time that Charlie Russell and his dad sitting in the den of their home there back east, and they heated their a hot iron in the fireplace, and then Charlie Russell burned his initials on the piece of wood that was over that fireplace.
The mantelpiece.
The mantelpiece, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they moved that when Bill moved to Montana. He still had that fireplace. Yeah. Uh-huh. I suppose it's still there at their ranch at Red Lodge. Mm-hmm. So, he's had some interesting stories. Bill McKay did. He was a, as he so told us, he said, I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth, and he was, you know. They had tremendous influence in Northwest Airlines, and his father was very heavily involved in the stock market at that time. So it was an interesting life. He was an interesting person, Bill McKay.
I remember him as a wonderful piano player.
Oh, yes. One time at the old Colonial, they had a piano, and you could eat dinner there and drinks and everything. And we went out there to dinner one evening, and the fellow that was playing the piano quit for a little while. So McKay went over and sat down and played the piano. And he had a big time playing the piano. And some guests then got up, and there was a little jar on the piano for the tips, you know. And they left McKay a dollar tip. So he thought that was the greatest thing that ever happened.
Probably the only time that ever happened to him in his life. Multi-millionaire, probably.
Yeah.
But he was a good piano player. Probably
he sure was.
A good feeling about it.
Yeah.
I bet it did.
Yeah.
He was also the Republican National Committee man for
Montana, for a long time. Mm-hmm.
And there was a...
He was a senior Republican in the Senate, too, for a long time.
Yeah. Do you remember attending Republican state conventions?
Yes. The one I remember the most was when... Reagan and Ford ran in the primary for the presidential nomination, and Sonny Lockram and I supported Ford.
Oh.
And the Stevens and
Colstead. Oh, Tom Rolfe.
Yeah, there's a group that were supporting Reagan, and we didn't get anything. Sonny and I didn't.
I remember it vividly because I was with you and Sonny.
Yep.
And what had happened, that was in 1976.
Yep.
And that was a real close contest between Ronald Reagan and then President Ford.
Yes.
And so every delegate counted in every state, and we'd had a straw vote in the Republican primary. It wasn't binding on the convention.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we had something like 18 delegates that we were qualified to send, and so we worked out the math, and the people had voted for Reagan, but by the way it would have worked is Reagan would have gotten 11 delegates and Ford would have gotten 7.
Mm-hmm.
So remember that?
Yes.
That was our strategy. I think it was something like 11 and 7 for unity, yeah, or something like, uh-huh, that. Well, the Reagan guys had apparently gone the opposite way in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
In the Minnesota State Convention, there had also been a straw vote. Ford had won it narrowly statewide. Every vote counted, so the Ford people took all whatever they were, 45 mm-hmm. votes or something, mm-hmm, from Minnesota.
Yeah.
So the Reagan people in Montana felt they had to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any particular hard feelings about it. I can remember talking to Alan Colstead about it. He said, Bob, this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
None of you guys are going, and we all are. And
that's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. We didn't get anything.
Didn't get anything. I remember that, too. They took every one of them. But I can remember at the time thinking, well, probably it's a roll of business. been reversed, we would have done the same thing.
The same thing,
under
maybe.
The circumstances, you know, because it was down to the point where at the national convention they felt that thing would turn on maybe just a couple
yes.
of dozen votes or something.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So it was serious business at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I remember that one too, and I remember Ronald Reagan was personally there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
And there was a fellow by the name of Tom Kleppe, who was the Secretary of Interior, and I think he'd been a congressman from North Dakota or something, and he was there to represent Reagan, and he was a good guy, he was a good mm-hmm. public speaker and that sort of thing, but, you know, they had Ronald Reagan,
mm-hmm.
this national celebrity,
mm-hmm.
and we had Tom Kleppe, you know, I mean, they had a fire hose to our water pistol. You
yeah,
know,
that's right.
Celebrity.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was quite a time. It really was.
You remember too the actor Festus?
Yes.
Ken Weaver or something
right.
like that was a fairly well known television actor at the time
uh-huh.
in a television series called Gunsmoke, and he was
yes.
there in behalf of Reagan. And
yeah,
kind
he
of
flew in
the
with
celebrity
Reagan.
Thing
yeah.
with Reagan.
Yeah, that's right.
People recognized him from
yeah.
television and that sort of thing. And,
yeah. Then so, years later, Reagan came to town. I can remember that there was a lady from Lewistown who was chairman of the Republican Party. That
Phyllis. Florence Hagan.
I know Reagan came in, and I was the minority leader in the Senate when he came in. He flew in on a private jet of the True family, and we met him at the airport.
The True family from Oil
from
in Wyoming?
Wyoming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They had their personal, I think that was the family that,
yeah.
they had, anyway, it was a Wyoming family that had the private jet that flew him in, and he landed there and then came up. I don't remember him making a presentation to the legislature, but I'm sure he did. But anyway, he came in, and Florence, she pushed everybody aside and trotted right in and kind of took over. But were you in the Senate when the Russians came?
Oh,
well,
I remember.
You had to be because yeah. Swindon was governor.
Yeah. I remember when one group of Russians were there, we didn't have any budget to entertain them. And that seems just ridiculous, but we
did entertain them, though. We took them to the, I don't know whether it's a colonial or something. I can remember.
The Montana Club, maybe?
Yeah, it could have been. I can remember going there and having dinner, and they passed around vodka. For us to have toasts with.
Yeah.
And, Ted was lieutenant governor, and Tom Judge didn't come, but Ted came.
Okay.
And so we were sitting there as the head of the Republican Party then, and entertaining the Russians. And then the next day, the leader of that particular group came up and spoke to the Senate
yeah.
through an interpreter.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a lot of fun, too.
Oh, it was. There was at least one other group of Russian legislators that came to Montana a few years after that, and I think they were from the Siberian region
yes.
of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And what I remember was that in the legislature, we didn't know how to. We wanted to take care of them one evening, so what we did is State Senator Mignon Waterman and her husband had a lovely home near the Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
And there were only about a half a dozen of these guys, so we got about twice that many legislators. I think we were all senators.
Mm-hmm.
And we went over to Mignon's house, and we had a very nice party and reception and dinner for him over
uh-huh.
there. But it was
uh-huh.
just around her big dining room table.
Yeah.
So that's just how it worked out.
Sure, sure. Yeah, we didn't take advantage of things that we should have, really.
Well, there yeah. was some kind of a funny budgeting problem, and
yeah.
we just decided to heck with it. We'd just take
Do
care
it
of it ourselves,
sure,
and we
sure.
did, and it was and fine. It wasn't,
sure, it worked out.
Wasn't
well.
Any big deal at all.
And, you know, I can't remember why Tom Judge didn't come to that party that we had. And there was a rather large group of us.
Yeah.
Russians and I know Swindon was there.
Yeah.
But I can't remember why Tom Judge didn't come.
Well, you know, that's maybe illustrative of a larger what was going on then, you know. Because,
oh, sure.
Because I think Tom Judge was a little detached at that point in time, and Ted Swindon was very,
oh, yes.
very,
yes.
very focused. And
yes.
then that led ultimately to Tom, who was out of state an extended period of time, late in that second term in
mm-hmm.
office, and that was when Ted Swindon, his lieutenant governor, made his move.
Yes.
And
it was a good move.
It was a good move and beat him in the Democratic primary.
That's right, because I can remember as president of the Senate, I would go down and talk with Ted, because I got to the point where I couldn't trust Tom Judge at all. I had a thing happen. I can't remember the fellow's name from the university that Groff and the Republicans in the Senate hired to help establish how much money we had, actual money we had, and where we stood financially in the state. And wish I could remember his name. But anyway, he was an economist from the university and working for the legislature, particularly Groff, because Groff was chairman of the Finance and Claims Committee. And I can remember him coming in and telling me that he said, we've made a mistake. I may have been minority leader then. As in a leadership position. He said, I found where we made a $6 million mistake. And it's, we've got less money than we thought we had by $6 million. And I could hardly wait till I got to tell Groff.
Oh,
so it made quite an impact. We finally got it resolved and got everything worked out. But we worked together to do it. But we didn't make too much of a political issue of it, but we did anyway. Then later on, when I was president of the Senate, I can remember a very similar thing happening when Jim Felt came up, and just maybe we better wait till that thing gets by. She's around on the other side of the house. So we anyway, Jim was probably, he was a minority leader in the House when Lucas was Speaker, and Jim was the author of the Senate Bill 33, or House Bill 333, the sales tax.
Jim Felt,
yeah. He was a tremendous tax attorney until he came up in the 79 session to work with the Republicans, and he knew how to, he could find more money and where money was going in the state better than anybody that ever served in the legislature. He was really quite talented that way. But he found a substantial mistake in some of the projections in the revenue. And I called Tom Judge, and I told Thomas, and Tom, this has happened, but I'm not gonna make a political issue out of it if you won't. And he said, no, we won't, so we'll just solve the problem and go on. Well, the next morning on the news, here I was sitting at breakfast with Bill Lowe, and here was Tom Judge on the radio telling you about this big mistake he had found in the budget. So I never went back to his office after that.
Oh,
I always dealt through Swindon.
Yeah.
But I never will forgive him for doing that to me.
It was like
he had done it all, you know. And I wasn't going to make a political deal out of it because we were having enough trouble as it was. But Tom just wasn't very honest. And that's why we got to go into Swindon and visiting with him. And if we had something to get done, we'd get it through his office. Because you could talk to Ted, and he was honest and dealt with you fairly.
And he also had influence with Democrat legislators
very
to
much.
Get things done.
Yes, very much.
Yeah, even as lieutenant governor.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, I admired Ted. He was a fine person.
Now, you had you were brand new when Nutter was governor.
That's right.
You knew Tim Babcock and served with him for a fair amount of time.
Yep, all his term.
All his term in office, and had a good working relationship with him.
Yes.
And of course, he was governor at the time of the first big sales tax controversy back in 1967.
Yep.
That was the bill that Jim Felt carried.
Yep.
Was House Bill 333?
No, the House Bill 333 was... Yeah, I guess it was.
Yeah,
it was. It was 333.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Jim was the author of it, and I carried it in the Senate. You can remember that.
Now, Republicans generally oppose taxes.
Yes.
Republicans, generally speaking, are the party of the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats more the party of the public sector, more willing to raise taxes and spend money to try to help people solve their problems.
Right.
Why did the Republican Party get associated with this new tax, the sales tax? It seems out of character for Republicans to support a new tax and for Democrats to oppose one.
Well, we were short of money. We had to raise some money.
But you didn't follow the same policy that Nutter followed.
No.
When there was a need to raise money, Nutter just decided to cut.
And we realized that we had to get more money, particularly for education, because we were probably having problems with the university system, problems with the K through 12 programs, and we needed more money. And just for the operation of the state, you know, the state's no different than any other business. Inflation affects the state government just as much as it does anybody else. But we realized that we had to have some more money because that we just didn't have enough money to balance the budget. So the Republicans came forward with the sales tax, and the Democrats were going to increase the income tax. And that's when we had the impasse and couldn't get things through. And Lucas was the carrier of the sales tax. I can't remember whether Groff or Gene Mahoney was the principal proponent of the increase in the income tax. And the Republicans got involved in it for that reason, not that we wanted to increase taxes, but we felt that that would broaden the base, tax base, for the whole state. Everybody had to pay sales tax. Didn't make any difference. We had the exemptions. It was a well-written bill. It still is. And
the exemptions were for things like medicine and groceries?
Groceries, yes, that type of thing. And we'd taken care of it. If I remember right, there was even provisions for people who rented property so that they got some relief as well as the property owners. But carried well in the House, came to the Senate. Dave Manning was chairman of the Senate Taxation Committee, and I was a fairly good friend of Dave's, and I carried the bill in the Senate. I don't remember whether you remember that. And I remember Jim came over and sat with me when I was carrying the bill in the Senate, but we presented it in the Senate Taxation Committee, and of course it was killed in the taxation committees, but I made my pitch on the floor of the Senate to bring it back out onto the floor of the Senate, and they were very courteous to me. Dave Manning was, in particular, was very courteous to me and let me make my presentation. Jim had fixed up billboards, and we had the whole thing all choreographed so that we could make a pretty decent presentation, and I got to make my presentation. And when I sat down, they called for a vote, and that was it. Nobody else got to say a word on either for or against it.
Didn't want a debate.
They just shut her off right there and then called for the vote, and that was the end of it. So
was it? It was almost party line, I think.
All party line, straight party line. Yeah. I don't even believe we lost it. I know we didn't lose a single Republican on that particular vote. Yeah. Because that was the first time it was in the Senate.
So that was in 67?
Yeah, I believe it was.
And so the income tax then was increased before that session ended, or what?
No, then we had deadlock because the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate was controlled by the Democrats. And they deadlocked, and then we had a special session in June, and we came back to Helena, a committee. I can't remember the size of the committee, but it doesn't make any difference. But Groff, I know, was the head of the Democrats on that particular committee, and Lucas was the chairman of the Republican group. And we met there for darn near a month in June, trying to thrash out some way to resolve the thing, and finally ended up deciding that we'd have a vote of the people.
Bill, I think that might have been 71.
Was it 71 that we had the one?
The sales tax surfaced in 67.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You're right. And then we tried again in 71.
Tried again in 71, because my first session was 71. First session was was this big impasse on the sales tax, and there were three Republicans in the House of Representatives that wouldn't support it.
Yep.
Ed Smith, Lou Perry, and Gary Marvin.
Gary Marvin, that's right.
And we had a heck of a time getting it out of the House, but we finally got it over there to you somehow or other.
Yep.
I can't remember, but maybe Dan Yardley and Dorothy Bradley are what I remember.
I can't remember who supported in the House, but I remember
a couple of Democrats. We never did get those three Republicans. We got it over to you in the House, in the Senate, and then they killed her in the Senate. It was dead on arrival over there.
Yeah, practically.
And then they couldn't get their income tax increase through the House. So we couldn't get our sales tax through the Senate, so that's when we put it on the ballot to let the people settle it.
Yep, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
And the people voted for, as I recall, a 35% increase in the income tax instead of a 2% sales tax.
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Because they was going to tax the rich.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea was that the income tax taxes
the rich. Yeah. 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 That's exactly right. I forgot that that was the second Johnny Lyon carried it in the Senate because I was a minority floor leader in 71. And that was
Johnny Lyon was a Republican senator from Shelby.
And he,
radio station owner, right?
That's right. Yeah. He carried the bill in the Senate. Yeah. Yeah, that was quite a time.
Now, a governor we haven't spoken about who had a pretty significant role in the period in which you were a member of the legislature was Governor Forrest Anderson, who was governor from 1968 to 1972. And he was governor during the period of executive reorganization.
Right, he was real strong in favor of that.
Do you remember much about that? Or?
Yes, I do. I remember that he was really a strong supporter of it, and I can't remember who it was that was opposing it so much. And it doesn't make any difference, I suppose, but he was a very strong supporter of it, and that was a pretty good move. One of the few things that I thought Forrest did that was good for the state. I was never an admirer of Forrest. I never felt he was honest, and you heard all kinds of stories about him, and whether or not they were true, I don't know, but I know that a lot of things that he did that I thought were uncalled for, and I just didn't care for him. And I can remember as minority leader in the Senate, I would take the senators down. He would invite us to a lunch once a week. And we'd go down to the big room in the just off the governor's office there where we have our meetings. And Forrest would have lunch brought in for us. And I would pick a different group of senators each time. And Jim would bring over members from the House and do the same thing. And I usually got there ahead of Jim because I didn't have the obligations that Jim did as far as running a house. But I'd get there ahead of him. And Forrest and I could get along pretty good. But the minute Lucas came in, the battle started. So it was well worth your time just to be there for lunch. It happened every week.
And I suppose Anderson saw Lucas as a potential rival.
Oh, yes. No question about it. He knew that Jim was going to run for governor. And he'd really take it out. And they were good debate. You know, they were very knowledgeable people.
Both smart men. I mean,
yeah, really were. And that it was fun to be there.
And, you know, you think about the physical contrast.
Oh,
there's Jim Lucas, 6'3", 6'4", something like that. Big, elegant, slow-moving, graceful, tall man. And Forrest, maybe 5'5", I don't know, 5'6", at the most. Just like a little peppery, bandy rooster.
Oh, yeah, and he was. he was something. Yeah. Wasn't Tom, that was the time Tom Judge was... With Tom, Lieutenant Governor then.
Under Anderson.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking,
And then, of course, he was governor for a long time, for eight years. Tom Judge was. And you were, I think, probably minority leader and president of the Senate at different times.
Yes, under Tom governor, Judge.
Under Tom Judge.
Right.
So you probably worked with him
on a number of things. We started in the House together. See, Tom was elected from Helena into the House, and it was the year I was elected here to the House. So we really started our legislative and political careers together at that time.
Now, there was a controversy, if I remember correctly, involving whether Tom Judge legitimately lived. Was it had he been a resident of Montana long enough?
I don't remember that, Tom. I really don't.
What I'm remembering about that was that when he was first elected, he had moved back to Montana. He'd gone out of state to... had a job somewhere out of state, and he'd returned to Montana, and he was elected to the legislature, and there was a question over whether he had met the residency requirement.
That is right. I remember that, and there was a debate in the House when he was elected to the House. I do remember
and
that.
The Republicans had the majority in the House, and there was a question about whether he should be legally seated in the House. Well, at the same time, I think maybe the Democrats came up with this. You know, they found that an old senator, wasn't old at the time, Jim Shaw.
Jim Shaw had the same problem.
Well, he was from Weibo, but there was a question about whether his ranch was in Weibo County, but his house could have been 25 feet into Custer County or Dawson County.
And
they were going to have to survey it and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So the Democrats' position over in the Senate was, we won't seat Shaw if the Republicans don't seat Judge. So the obvious deal was worked out. Well, they just
seated them both.
Yeah,
I can remember that now as I recall. Yeah, quite the deal.
So you'd known Tom Judge from the time you started out with him when you were both freshmen
in the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. But still, you felt he kind of misused you on that.
There's no question that he did. Yeah. I never will forgive him for that, because I tried to do what was best for the state and what I thought should be done, and that it wasn't an issue that needed to be made a political issue at all. And he made it, and I kept my mouth shut. So that didn't hurt anything. We got it all straightened out, but I've never forgiven him for doing that to me.
Now, at the same time, when you served in the Senate, you served for an extensive period of time with Stan Stevens.
Yes.
Who later became governor.
Governor, uh-huh.
And I believe, was it Stan who appointed you to the Board of Regents?
No, Swindon appointed me to the Board of Regents in 88.
I see.
Yeah, I'd just gotten off of the, I was still on the Federal Reserve Board. I can't remember whether I just off or on, but Swindon called me. I was in vacationing in Arizona, and he called me. Anyway, and asked me if I would serve on the Board of Regents. Fellow that ran the airport there in Helena had been a member of the board and gotten some kind of, did something that wasn't quite kosher, and so rather than embarrass anybody, he just resigned. And Swindon called me and asked me if, and he was a Republican, he had to balance the board.
Yeah.
And Swindon called me and asked me if I would serve, and I told him I'd serve for 1 year at least. And then I went ahead and served for quite a long time, and worked with Ted on the Board of Regents too.
Typically, governors don't attend Regents meetings. I don't know. Did Swindon?
No, Swindon only came one time, and Stevens, I don't believe Stan ever came but once or twice. But Mark Roscoe attended every meeting when I was the chairman of the Board of Regents. And never missed anything, and had it put input into the meeting of the Board of Regents too. So, Swindon, I visited with Swindon a lot, and I did with Stan too. I'd go up and tell him what we were doing and why we were doing it, and worked closely with them. But Stan only attended one time when we thought that we had were requesting too much money, and he came in and talked to the board about our position, and I don't remember the outcome. But at Swindon, if he came once, I don't remember just when it was. But when Mark Roscoe was elected governor, then he came to every meeting.
Bill, do you remember any issues or anything that came before the Board of Regents you were there that are especially memorable?
Well, the election of the president. We elected George Dennison, president of University of Montana, Mike Malone, president of MSU. Can't remember the man's name, Northern, and later the president of School of Mines. Those were big issues. The big issue we had at the time was trying to get enough money to support and not have to raise tuition. We did have to raise tuition finally, but that was the big thing, just the money situation and trying to make the thing work.
and trying to save some of the programs at the university. In particular, I can remember the School of Pharmacy. It looked like they were going to shut it down, and I thought that was a terrible mistake. And we were able to save that school. We had a physical therapy department too, but it went by the wayside eventually. But money problems were the big problems. That, and then one time there was a move to take Montana, the University of Montana in Bozeman, and change their classification so they went into the same class as the North Dakota schools as far as their football teams were concerned. And that was kind of a pretty strong issue too. And surprisingly, Mark was in, Roscoe was in favor of doing that, and I didn't. Don't want to do that. I thought it was a mistake. It's too much travel, and I just thought that we were doing all right as we were. We weren't losing that much money, but and the board supported my position. But and Mark wasn't overly upset about it, but he felt that that was one way that we could probably cut down on the cost of operating the university.
Was by traveling to North Dakota and playing those schools rather than traveling down into Nevada and Arizona and.
Yeah.
Was that it?
Yeah.
We would have been at a different conference?
We would have been different, yeah. Different,
I see.
A lower grade, you know, there's I think, the three different grades in this one.
Yeah.
Same class as University of North Dakota and North Dakota State. I can't remember that. I just remember those two. In South Dakota, those were the schools that would have been in the conference that we would have been in. Class B or what it was called,
yeah.
But it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, but that was the class, and I thought it was a mistake, so I didn't support that.
Anything else that you can think of comes to mind as a member of the Board of Regents?
No, it was a very difficult position to be in because you were always looking for money.
Yeah.
And every time you turned around, everything just kept going up, prices of everything. I can remember going to Bozeman. I tried to visit the universities, and I was in Bozeman, and we were, Teach was president then, and the gas line out behind the student union ruptured while I was there. And fortunately, they were able to shut it off. And what a catastrophe that could have been. If somebody had thrown a cigarette in that thing, no telling what it would have blown up. But we were able to convince the legislature because of that we needed to do something about those old utility structures. And that's when they redid the center of the Bozeman and redid that old heating units and those things, and were able to improve the structure some. And that was another problem we had, trying to just maintain the buildings and all. But we had a group of that. I thought Regents that worked well together, and the governor was fairly supportive of us.
And during the 80s and 90s, Montana was broke.
Yes.
So you had a difficult period there where
yes.
The university system, of course, acquires a fair amount of resources function.
Yeah.
And it was really difficult to come up with any revenue to support us,
I suppose.
And then as I remember it too, Schwinnen's attitude toward tax increases was maybe not greatly different than Nutter's.
No, it wasn't. It really wasn't. No. Now, of course, we didn't, right at the first, when Swindon was still governor, I was just fairly new to the board, and Lind from Missoula was chairman.
And Dennis Lind, the lawyer from Missoula.
Yeah, Dennis. And then Swindon didn't run, did he? And that was when Mark Roscoe was elected.
Well, Stevens came in after.
Oh, Stevens did. That's
yeah.
Right, I forgot. Stevens came in.
And Stevens, of course, held the line on spending and taxes, too.
Oh, yeah.
Or tried to.
You know,
was his philosophy.
Stan was a good friend of mine, but Stan really never fully understood government, I never thought. He just, when we were in the Senate, you were there, you know, that Turnage and myself and a few others kind of were the leaders of the Senate. Stan was the, was one of the leaders, but he never was real strong. And when he was the floor leader, you were there, and you remember all of those problems we had. He was floor leader, and Alan Colstead was president pro tem. But Turnage and myself, really were the strong leader. Not that I'm so darn smart, but and I think that we were the leaders of the Senate.
I remember Stan as being a beautifully good public speaker.
Yes, very good.
And apparently he had owned a radio station.
Yes.
Maybe still did, and he gave radio commentaries that were got a lot of praise because mm-hmm. he was able in just a little 2 or 3 minute commentary to say a lot and say
yes.
it really well. And I can remember Stan standing up on the floor, and he'd stand up on the floor of the Senate and he'd step around behind his chair
mm-hmm.
and push his chair up under his desk. And then he'd stand there, he wasn't a very large man,
mm-hmm.
and he'd stand there with his hands on the back of his chair and he'd stand just straight as a ramrod and look right straight forward mm-hmm. at the presiding officer, and he'd deliver this beautiful little 3 minute,
mm-hmm.
just really, really,
really
nicely
suck
done.
It to you, yeah.
Just eloquent and very well said. But that was kind of it.
Yeah.
But in terms of the having to master the
overall
operation, the details and stuff, he could given a little bit of time and preparation, he could put our case beautifully into words in a
mm-hmm.
real nifty little commentary. Mm-hmm. That was his great strength. That's what I remember his great strength was. But I don't remember him ever carrying a big horrible 30-page bill, you know, through 2 hours of debate.
No,
I don't remember
No, and there no was he ever very active in the financial portion of the. So he never served on taxation or the Finance and Claims Committee or those committees. So no. Well, he was on the Finance and Claims. I was thinking of the Senate tax when he wasn't on taxation. Senate Finance Committee. He was not on that. But he was on the interim committee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, he was a fine person. I liked Stan. We became very close friends. But I didn't think he was as well qualified in understanding government as he possibly could have been. But he learned. And he worked at it.
He had a tough time as governor.
Oh, yes.
The state's economy was in the bucket.
Had a hell of a time.
And he had battles with the press and
mm-hmm.
had difficulty getting started. He told me that one time that he said, you know, he had in mind a number of people to help him with state government. Of course, the Republicans had no governor for 20 years.
That's right.
So the whole state bureaucracy was people who'd been appointed come to work, you know, for Democratic administrations.
Yep.
And so Stan might have been able to promote some of those people and keep some of them on and that sort of thing, but he felt, since his was the first Republican administration in 20 years, the people had voted for a change,
mm-hmm.
and they were entitled to what they voted for, so he wanted to replace all the 20 top department directors with Republicans. And he had in mind having private sector people from around the state come in and kind of put the Republican
mm-hmm.
philosophy to work in state government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those jobs aren't particularly prestigious.
No.
They don't pay that well. You've got some bright young fellow from Billings who could be a wonderful director of some department or other, but he's making twice as much money as Billings, would have to uproot himself, move to Helena for maybe just 4 years.
That's right.
For a job that wouldn't be a particularly impressive thing on his resume
mm-hmm.
anyway. And Stan told me he got his third and in some cases fourth choices.
Yes.
On some of those important jobs. Well, then you remember too that in the first 6 months of his administration there were some outrageous things in the news about things that surfaced in the background of two or three of the people that he appointed, and there were embarrassing resignations, and,
mm-hmm.
and he got off to a terrible stumbling start.
Yeah, he appointed I can't remember who it was. He appointed the first budget director. In
Ray Shackelford.
Was that who it was?
Yeah.
I told him, I said, Dan, you're making a mistake. And we visited a while. I said, you ought to just get Dave Lewis back. Dave Lewis knows the business and everything, and he'd help you by far. I don't remember whether right after Ray he appointed someone else, but he did eventually appoint Dave Lewis as the budget director. Yeah. So. And I always felt that, well, maybe I helped a little bit.
I think you might have. I tried to help you, too, and it didn't work out particularly well. I don't know if it would have, but I told him, I met with him. Remember he took a vacation?
No, I don't
right
remember.
Right after the election, he was bone tired, and he took 2 or 3 weeks off and just left the state and got some rest and recuperation. And he came back from that, and he was in the little transition office there in the Capitol building, and... you know, I think he was feeling kind of overwhelmed and
mm-hmm.
trying to make a whole bunch of decisions that
mm-hmm.
maybe he'd postponed for a week or two and shouldn't have. And so I went in and dropped in on him and always felt close to him personally. He was really kind to me when I was a young legislator. Uh-huh. He was our floor leader and president of the Senate and that sort of thing. And he was always, you know, I wasn't always on the reservation, and he was kind and patient with me. Anyway, I went in and I said, you know, I think we're in a position of power now because you're the first Republican governor in 20 years, and, you have a good working relationship. You always have with the Democrats in the legislature. We've got the, as I remember it, we had the majority in the Senate, I think. And John Vincent, I think, was the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
That's right.
The Democrats had a narrow majority there, but John was a kind of a Democrat that you could talk to. He wasn't an inflexible Democrat. And I suggested to Stan that right there, when the iron was hot, right after our victory, when we had some power and some momentum, he should maybe request a meeting with John Vincent and just try to preliminarily at least find out what were the most important priorities to John and share with John what the most important priorities with us would be. So we might be able to avoid some big battle down the line. We might be able to just kind of get a couple of important things settled right to begin with. And he said he was reluctant to do that because Vincent was a liberal, and he said he just didn't want to have to work with those guys. He said, you know, he said he thought he could develop improve on a good working relationship that he'd always had with the Butte Democrats. And he said he thought he could kind of pry them loose from the regular Democrats and form a solid working majority with the Butte Democrats and the Republicans. And I guess I thought at the time, well, usually the Butte Democrats exact a price for their cooperation.
You bet. Always.
You know that.
You bet.
And so I thought, you know, you might just be able just a kind of a summit conference, you know, with Vincent, just man to man, come to an agreement that you wouldn't have to trade any horses for down the line.
Sure.
And but he said no. He said he was uncomfortable doing that, and he was going to work with the Butte delegation. And I, you know, again, I'm not claiming any superior wisdom or anything, but I think he might have been better off to go.
Oh, I know he would have been. Yeah, but he was dead set in some of his ideas, and you couldn't sway him either from those positions, you know. So, but I got along with him well, and I worked as close as I could as chairman of the Board of Regents with him, and he got upset with us a time or two over the spending positions. But there was a time when I always felt on the Regents that we needed to represent the university system, and that was our prime position, and we had to support the universities and give to the legislature our opinions of what money and why we needed those additional dollars in order to run the university system. And I always felt that that took precedence over whether I was a Republican or a Democrat. That was my my need at that time, was to represent them. And I tried to do that as best I could. And I was criticized some for it, but not too much. Most people supported that position. And so we had a good, but I can remember having Stan and I both were in Bozeman when we raised the tuition on the students to support the university. I believe it was maybe the first time it had been raised in quite some time. But anyway, we raised it and had a big meeting in the gym there at Bozeman. And oh my goodness, I remember one boy came up to the podium and took off his shirt, said, "Just take it too." And some lady who was, and I felt so sorry for her, she was a single parent and was having trouble. You know, she's going to school, trying to improve her position in life, so to speak, and she made her presentation very cheerful type of thing. Maybe it was a little tough. But we stood our ground and raised the tuition. And, of course, it's been raised several times since then.
It's been raised several times since then.
Yeah, it's, the students support it more than the state.
Yeah.
And I think that was too bad, because you eliminate a lot of students that could go to school and maybe help themselves through life.
And we don't have that strong of a community college system to take up the slack. If we had a junior college or community college system where those kids could kind of
meld into
meld
the whole
in, then,
yes.
But we don't really have that either.
No, with just the three junior colleges, they just don't represent enough people. And for some reason, there's a stigma attached to the fact that you go into a junior college when you shouldn't be. And a lot of the students are better off going to the junior college and getting their feet kind of in the put into the fire, so to speak, so that they could accomplish something once they got in the four-year schools. That was quite an issue. And then the fact that so many students were not able to get out in 4 years, too. Some of it because we didn't have enough instructors, and some of it because they just there was just too much that they had to support themselves, and they couldn't take the classes necessary to finish in 4 years, and that's expensive. That one more year for those additional students was quite a problem, and they're still wrestling with that.
Yeah,
so it's but we were lucky. I think not that I was so smart, but I thought got some real good presidents in and kind of changed the structure and combined the system to where we now have the university buildings and they're all under one head and all of that. So I think that was a good move. That happened just after I went off the board, but it was one of the reasons that I resigned from the board was that I felt that that was a strong issue and it should be addressed. My term was going to end in the mid-year, and in that summer I went to Roscoe and told him I was going to resign and that I was going to do it so he could appoint someone that could be there when that transition took place and could understand it, and then they would be able to make their presentation to the legislature if they had to. And that was the year that Davidson, was that his name, from Billings?
Yeah, yeah.
They appointed him.
Bill, a couple more questions. We're running close to the end of our tape here. Any thoughts on coal and energy and that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. I was served on the coal committee that that established the tax with Tom Tao. Dave Manning was chairman, Walter Ulmer. I believe Walter was vice chairman. Dan Kemis, myself, Tom Tao, and the lady from Kalispell.
Ora Halverson?
Was it Oren? Yeah.
Ora Halverson?
Yeah. In,
she was a representative from Kalispell?
That's right. Served in now. She was on that committee, too. And we did draft that legislation. Roger Tippy, who worked for the Legislative Council.
As an attorney,
yeah. He drafted the legislation, actually, that increased the coal tax and established the coal tax, not Tom Tao. Roger Tippy did it under the direction of this committee. And we formed that committee, and we approved that increase in the taxation on coal, and we put it into two bills. Ora carried it in the House, and Tom Tao carried it in the Senate. And when we had a meeting of the taxation committee, they both passed the House and the Senate, and then we had a joint conference to see which bills were going to be presented. Well, in order to determine which member, I was chairman of the taxation committee, in order to remember which person would present the bill, we flipped a coin, and Tom Tao was able to present it in the Senate. I've always thought that's the biggest mistake I've made in the legislature, because I could have very easily just turned it over to Ora, and since it started in the House, and brought it right up through the House. But
now, when was that, 81?
Yep. No.
79?
79 had to be.
Because the, and so...
77 or 70, 77 maybe.
And so what was the level of the coal tax then? The was that the 30% coal tax?
Yep, 30%. Then I wrote the minority report on it because I thought it was too much. And I voted against it in the committee and wrote a minority report. And the representative from Cuba, Puerto Rico, from
Great Gulf. Fabriga.
Fabriga and I turned in a minority report because we felt it was too high and not competitive with Wyoming. Anyway, we didn't get anywhere, but then it was passed and came to the Senate and to the House, like I said.
Yeah.
And was passed at, was it 30%?
I think the initial tax was 30%.
I think so too, either 30 or 35.
But I had remembered that, why did I think that might have happened? You were chairman of the taxation committee, so that had to have been 77.
77.
Because we didn't have the majority in 75.
That's right.
So, okay, and so because Tom Tao, of course, I think would want to be remembered as the father of the coal tax.
Oh, yes, no question
and
about it.
And looking back, then when Schwinden became governor, it was reduced to 15%, I think,
yeah,
and that was the so-called window of opportunity where he said that if more coal is produced, it can be produced at this lower rate. And the idea was to provide an inducement or an incentive for coal companies to develop more coal.
That's right. Do you remember, I was president of the Senate, and I introduced some bills relating to the coal tax situation, and one of them was a reduction in the tax on coal. We passed it in the Senate, but it never got out of the House. In fact, that was in 79, and the talk that I was possibly running for governor, I didn't get a piece of legislation passed in the House in that whole year.
Really? They just stonewalled you in the House?
Yeah.
They didn't want to get you?
There wasn't any question about it. My name was on it, came off.
That's interesting. Yeah. That would have been in
79.
In 79,
yep.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, in that session in 79. And that was when Jim Felt was up there helping me and God, we had everything set up.
Let's see, who would have been the speaker in 79?
Gherke.
Oh, Gherke was in 79.
Harold Gherke.
Yeah, he was two different times, I guess, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Bill, we're coming to the end of our tape. Anything you'd like to say in conclusion?
No, I think that was it. I thought the big issues that occurred while I were there, of course, was the sales tax and the coal tax. Those were the two things that I remember the most and the most interesting to challenges to present to the legislature and to the people, too.
Well, appreciate your good service and appreciate your willingness to cooperate on this project.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Bill.
Uh-huh.